The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. My name is Melanie Hildreth, and I'm here today with IJ Senior Attorney Tim Keller and IJ Attorney Erica Smith. Today, we're going to do a deep dive into Blaine Amendments. For listeners who may not have ever heard of Blaine Amendments before, that's likely to change. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court accepted IJ's educational choice case that has at its heart the question of whether these controversial state constitutional provisions can be squared with the federal constitution. So, Erica, let's start by talking about that case. Can you describe the facts that and what's at stake?
Sure. So this all started in 2015 when the Montana legislature passed its first school choice program. This program was designed for low-income families who had kids who were just not doing well in the public school for whatever reason that may be, so they can get scholarships to go to private school. Lots of families were really happy. This was really exciting news. But then things started getting pretty ugly. A state agency came in and passed a regulation that said that kids could only use scholarships at non-religious schools. So IJ immediately sued the day the law went into effect. And we won in the court below. We claimed that this violated the religious liberty rights of parents. And we took it to the Montana Supreme Court. Now, the Montana Supreme Court actually struck down the entire program, saying that just the fact that one kid might go to a religious school made the entire thing unconstitutional under the state constitution. And the specific constitutional provision at play was what was called Montana's Blaine Amendment.
And this is a little bit different than a typical IJ school choice case for the listeners who are familiar with our work in this area. Usually, we are defending programs that were passed, not filing a lawsuit. Can you describe how that, why that happened differently in this instance?
Sure. So usually, anytime a school choice program is passed anywhere in the country, people will challenge it in court. That's typically teachers' unions. So we are the experts on this issue, the experts on the constitutionality of giving parents school choice. So we'll jump in on behalf of parents and help the government defend the program from attack. We've been doing that very successfully for 30 years. This was different because here we were the plaintiffs. We were the ones attacking a government law because it was limiting the school choice of parents. So we're still representing the families, still representing their interests, but we are on the offensive here, not the defense.
So the Montana Supreme Court struck it down, and we appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, found out that they're going to take the case. How surprised were you when that happened?
I was not surprised at all. I think we all knew this was coming for a long time. Blaine Amendments have been a huge barrier to school choice programs for years, and they are constantly used to try to limit parents' educational options. So this was ripe for the Supreme Court review, and we are very happy it's there now.
And what is the, I know the way that briefs to the Supreme Court are set up, you're usually asking one question, just putting one question before them, or maybe more. But in this case, was it just one?
In this case, it was just one question. And that's whether interpreting Montana's Blaine Amendment to exclude religious options in these school choice programs is constitutional. Can the government come in and say, you cannot have a student aid program that gives parents the choice of going to a religious school?
So, Tim, let's talk a little bit more about Blaine Amendments and where they came from. Where else, or is there anywhere else that you see these in other educational choice cases and other types of cases? Where do they come up?
So there are Blaine Amendments in 37 state constitutions, and they have been involved in the earliest of IJ's cases. As a matter of fact, since IJ opened its doors in 1991, there hasn't been a single day that we haven't been in court somewhere in this country either defending a school choice program from legal attack or challenging some aspect of a school choice program ourselves in order to ensure that it provides the broadest array of options to families as possible. Typically, that comes in the form of cases like the Montana, where states try to exclude religious options for families, and we want to make sure that parents have as many options as possible for their kids. So we faced a Blaine Amendment in our very first school choice in Wisconsin, where the teachers' unions challenged the program and said it violated the Blaine Amendment. Blaine Amendments typically have language like the following. They vary from state to state in some minor details, but typically they say something to the effect of, there shall be no appropriation of public funds in aid of sectarian schools. Montana's is a little different. We can talk about some of the details there, but that's typically what it says. And IJ's position is that school choice programs don't violate state Blaine amendments because school choice programs aren't passed in aid of schools, sectarian or otherwise. They're passed in aid of families. They're designed to give parents educational options for their kids and make sure that they can put their kids in the school that's going to best suit their child's individual needs.
So the language that you just described, it doesn't sound too problematic. It just sounds like a church-state separation question. What is it about Blaine amendments that makes them particularly pernicious?
So it's always been IJ's position that properly interpreted, state Blaine amendments should not be a barrier to school choice programs. Again, because school choice programs aren't passed in aid of schools, they're passed in aid of families. So it's always been our position that if you just simply apply the plain language of the program, school choice should be constitutional under a Blaine Amendment. However, they do have a really ugly history behind them, and many states have interpreted them to preclude school choice programs or other educational aid programs throughout their history. So I'll dive into the history a little bit.
This is the podcast where we get nerdy.
That's right. Blaine amendments are named after a politician by the name of James G. Blaine, who served in Congress both as the Speaker of the House of Representatives and also as a senator over his 20-year career in the late 1800s. And James Blaine was a political animal who, in addition to serving in Congress, had his eye on the U.S. presidency, and he was willing to seize onto any issue that he thought might propel him to the presidency. And one of those issues was the question of whether or not public school funds could be shared with Catholic schools. We have to understand that in the late 1800s, our public school system, which was then known as a common school system, was not the thoroughly non-religious, secular institutions that we know public schools to be today. Instead, the public schools were primarily Protestant in orientation. The folks who promoted a common school system believed that they should be used to promote morality, and the tool for promoting morality that they used in the public schools was the Protestant Bible, the King James Bible. And there would be Bible reading. There would sometimes be hymns sung in the schools. And in the late 1800s, there was a massive wave of Catholic immigration into the country. And as those Catholic immigrants started enrolling their students in our public schools, they objected to the fact that it was Protestant in orientation. And they started lobbying for and agitating for a share of the public school funds, saying if the Protestants have their public schools, we ought to have a school system of our own, a separately publicly funded system of Catholic schools. And that created a huge backlash in the country because the country was still at that time primarily, predominantly Protestant. And James Blaine said, if I seize this Protestant angst, this anger at the Catholic immigrants for proposing that we share the common school fund between Protestant and Catholic schools by proposing an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would bar funding for sectarian schools, and at the time it was an open secret, and the U.S. Supreme Court has actually acknowledged this in its opinions, that it was an open secret that sectarian was code for Catholic. And so James Blaine proposed an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would prohibit the states from funding sectarian schools.
In the Constitution. What happened?
It is not. So what happened is after it was James Blaine introduced the amendment in Congress, it actually passed the House and moved over to the Senate, where it died. And it did not amend the U.S. Constitution, but two things happened. Well, historically, there were two things. Number one, the federal Blaine Amendment was actually modeled on what we sometimes now call proto-Blaine amendments. A handful of states amended their constitutions to preclude the funding of sectarian schools, and James Blaine modeled his amendment on some of those earlier proto-Blaine amendments. And then even though the amendment failed at the federal level to amend the U.S. Constitution, individuals in Congress who thought like Blaine thought were able to force newly admitted states to include Blaine language in their state constitutions. And so as a result, what we see today is there are 37 states with Blaine language embedded in their state constitutions.
So they came up in an educational choice context or in an education context, really. Are they ever used anywhere else? We see them in our cases. Is that something that has grown, or has it pretty much been contained? Have they popped up a lot over history, or are we just seeing a resurgence? Sort of what happened since the 1800s?
So they've been used in a number of variety of contexts. At the time of the big controversy regarding the funding of schools, Catholic organizations were also seeking funding for a variety of other Catholic institutions, Catholic orphanages, Catholic hospitals, and some of the Blaine Amendments are actually written such that they don't just bar aid to sectarian schools, but sometimes to sectarian institutions. And again, every time you look at those language, what they really meant was no public dollars for Catholic institutions.
Does that become a problem with hospitals or in other...
Generally not, because what is developed is, at least in the context of that sort of public welfare programs with regard to health care and other things, the courts have said, oh, well, that's a public purpose, and we're going to allow the funding to flow to these Well, let me back up a step. When you're talking about hospitals, health care, the courts properly recognize that those programs are benefiting individuals. And you rarely hear a court say, oh, that healthcare program that pays for individuals' services that they receive from a hospital, that's an appropriation in aid of hospitals. No, it's an appropriation in aid of the individuals who are using the hospital services. And they tend to get it right in those contexts. But when they look at school choice programs, they tend to suddenly view the world a little differently, and suddenly they say, no, the school choice program is aid to private schools.
Yeah. Nobody would say that food stamps are an aid of grocery stores, but for some reason, when you talk about school choice, it's a different story.
So given this background, they've continued to exist in states. How is that possible? Because the country has changed a lot, that kind of overt anti-Catholic bigotry that existed at that time doesn't really exist now. So why aren't they struck from the books?
There hasn't been a move to do that. I mean, there's just so much momentum behind them, and it's so hard to get a state constitution to change. A lot of times it takes 3/4 of the legislature to do so. It takes a lot of work, a lot of lobbying, and it just hasn't happened yet in a single instance.
And I think beyond that, and that's all very true, our terminology has changed. It used to be the case that our public schools were considered non-sectarian, even though there was this generic form of Protestantism in the public schools because they weren't teaching specific doctrines of specific churches. But now when we use that word sectarian, it's really just used as a synonym for religion. And at the same time, as the Blaine Amendments were cropping up, there wasn't the same rigid notion of a separation between church and state as we now understand separation of church and state. And so when you combine those two factors, people now, you know, read these Blaine Amendments and they say, oh, these aren't anti-Catholic amendments. They're just state religion clauses.
And in a lot of states, it hasn't been a problem, fortunately. There's 37 of them, but it's only been a problem really in 14 states. A lot of the other states have interpreted them to just be synonymous with the First Amendment and the federal constitution, which freely allows school choice programs. So really, the problem is in these 14 states that have this very bad case law that's interpreting these amendments.
And that federal interpretation aligns essentially with IJ's argument. So we are trying to encourage the states that have the Blaine Amendments to read them the way that the more permissive states have done. Is that?
So yes. So most of our litigation early on involved defensive actions where we were trying to defend a school choice program from legal attack. And in those situations, our opponents always brought two lines of attack. First, the state constitutional attack, saying that these programs violate state constitutional provisions, the Blaine Amendment included. and also a line of attack saying it violates the federal Constitution's Establishment Clause. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says that Congress shall not establish a religion, and they said that allowing families to choose religious schools violates the Establishment Clause. IJ eventually drove the federal issue up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in 2002, in a landmark case named Zelman v. Simmons-Harris, the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, it does not violate the U.S. Constitution to allow families to choose religious schools as part of an otherwise neutral school choice program, as long as two things are true. Number one, the government is truly remaining neutral with regard to religion, meaning it's neither favoring nor disfavoring religion over non-religion or favoring one religion over another. And number two, that parents were exercising a genuine and independent choice as to where they sent their kids to school. And as long as those two things were true, they said school choice is perfectly constitutional under the Establishment Clause. But that case didn't answer the question, could a state design a program that from the start excludes religious options? And it's always been IJ's opinion that a state could not do that consistent with the federal constitution. Because again, the touchstone of the constitutional analysis is neutrality. They're not to favor or disfavor religion. But by excluding religious options for families, they are, de facto, discriminating against religion.
It's showing complete hostility toward religion, which is a big no-no under federal constitution.
I really enjoyed seeing some of the stories coming out of Montana as you were putting together the petition to the Supreme Court, not just the story of our clients, but some of the other families that are participating or want to participate in the program. Can you tell a couple of their stories to kind of put, because this is all very theoretical, legal sort of discussion, historical analysis, with respect to what it really means to people, like how does it play out in Montana and elsewhere?
This means a lot to a lot of people. The stories are inspiring, but they're also gut-wrenching because they show you how much is at stake. Like take our lead client, for instance, Kendra Espinoza. She's currently working two jobs just to keep her kids in their private school. She works during the day as an office manager and at night as a janitor cleaning classrooms just to make the month-to-month payments. Her daughters were initially in public school, but it just wasn't working for them. Her oldest daughter was getting bullied. Her youngest daughter was falling behind in her classes. But now that they're in their private school, they're flourishing and they're so happy. And Kendra's thrilled to have them there. But she needs these scholarships to keep them, and she shouldn't have to be working around the clock just to make the payments. And there's other families, too. There's another kid who is getting bullied and beat up in his school. So he transferred to a Catholic school where he's doing great. He's one of the top tennis players in the whole state. There's another kid who's living with his grandparents and they're living on their Social Security payments and just trying to get by. And this scholarship was the only thing letting him stay in his school. So we hear these stories over and over again. This has a real effect on real people.
Yeah, these precise stories play out over and over again all across the country. We've faced Blaine Amendment challenges in states like Georgia, where we represented a single mom and her two daughters. And just like Kendra, the single mom was working multiple jobs to make ends meet and was desperately relied on the scholarships to keep her daughters at the schools that were meeting their needs. In Arizona, where we had to face a Blaine Amendment challenge, we represented families of students with disabilities. One of my favorite stories there is of Andrea Weck, one of our lead clients in that case. Her daughter was born with cerebral palsy and autism and was originally told that she would never walk, never talk, never succeed. And the public schools where she was enrolled simply reinforced that mentality. And it wasn't acceptable for Andrea. And so she ensured that her daughter was in a terrific school. And now Lexi, who is 18 now, when we first met her, she was six.
She was so little.
She was so little. But now she is thriving. And she engages in all sorts of terrific activities, from rock climbing, horse riding. She uses her iPad to speak. She's still nonverbal, but she communicates thanks to specialized apps that give her a voice. And she was even able to dance with her mom at her mom's wedding when Andrea remarried. And these are the types of stories that just play, like I said, they play out all across the country. And Andre would tell you if she was sitting here today that Lexi's doing so well because she was given the opportunity to attend schools that knew how to work with her, specialized education. And you know, it was, thankfully, the Blaine Amendments weren't able to prevent the school choice programs from going into effect in states like Arizona, Georgia, but states like Montana and the 14 other states that Erica mentioned, they're serious threats. And this case that we have in front of the U.S. Supreme Court has an opportunity to eliminate this threat to school choice nationwide.
So this case comes up in the context of a tax credit scholarship. Before we lost this case, we had never lost a tax credit scholarship on Blaine or anything else. Is that right?
That's right.
So this was a big change. And it's really great to see the opportunity to just keep it at one, overturn it, and then kind of set the path forward. So if the court rule it, one of the things that I wanted to talk about is sort of what the consequences of this case could be. What if we lose? What if we win? You know, the court often likes to rule narrowly. What if we rule, if they rule narrowly in our favor? What if they give us a sweeping ruling? How does the world change? How does the law change in sort of a practical way?
Well, we're not going to lose. We're definitely going to win this case. I think one of the biggest things that could come out of this is right now state legislatures consider every year whether or not to pass school choice programs. There's 60 programs right now in about 28 different states plus D.C., but that still leaves a lot of states without a school choice program, a lot of kids without that option. And some states are afraid to pass these programs because they're afraid to run up against their Blaine Amendment. If we win this case, that would be give an opening to these states to finally pass these programs and help tens of thousands of kids across the country.
And is there a possibility for a narrow ruling versus a sort of broad sweeping ruling, or is it pretty much thumbs up, thumbs down? They prohibit this kind of program. They don't. Just how much nuance is there in what could happen? I know that guessing with the Supreme Court is always a risky business, but just in terms of the array of options, how wide is that?
I think it would be very difficult to craft any sort of narrow decision. The question presented is pretty straightforward.
It's kind of black and white. Can you have a religious exclusion in one of these programs or not? And that's what's been holding them back. A legislature doesn't want to pass one of these programs if it knows kids can only choose from like a very small segment of private schools. So I agree with you. I think it's unlikely we would have a narrow ruling, and I think this is going to open up school choice for a lot of kids.
And does that include in states where in the past we may have lost on where we may have lost on a Blaine provision? It just wipes that state court ruling off the books? Or
I think we would be able to relitigate those cases and win them. Like Virginia is a great example. In Virginia, you can have a tax credit program, but you can't have a publicly funded program. I don't know if you want us to get into the details of the differences there, but it's limiting. And this decision can open that up to a lot of new states.
And even in states that operate programs where there is no Blaine Amendment, there are two states in this country, Maine and Vermont, which operate town tuitioning systems. And the way a town tuitioning system works is that there are a number of communities in rural parts of those states that simply don't have enough students to operate their own public schools. So the towns, instead of operating a school of their own, simply provide tuition to parents to attend the school of their choice. But both Maine and Vermont exclude religious options from those programs. A ruling in this case should apply in those states and prevent the state from discriminating against religious options for families. So if we prevail, it should have a wide-ranging impact on existing programs like Maine and Vermont, even though there's no Blaine Amendment in those states, as well as states where we've had prior litigation and run into Blaine obstacles.
So if we win then, IJ is the lawyers for the educational choice movement. If we win, is our work over? Is it done? And
definitely.
You guys have to move on to something else?
Definitely not.
It would be great if we could declare that, yes, this was the end of the school choice battles, but it's not. And this is best told in a story that one of our colleagues at IJ a number of years ago debated one of the lead lawyers for the National Education Association. And during that debate, he said, and this was right after we won the Zelman case and had settled the question of whether school choice was constitutional under the federal constitution, and it is. And he said, we will abandon the Establishment Clause and we will pursue any means we can to eliminate school choice, from high and lofty principles like state Blaine amendments to Mickey Mouse procedural tactics like the single subject rule. And his point was that they were not going to stop. They are going to comb through state constitutions and continue to find avenues for challenging school choice programs. And indeed, in many of the cases where we do face Blaine amendments or a Blaine argument, it's just one of many provisions that they grasp onto to try and halt school choice mm-hmm. in its tracks. Yeah. So we will still have to continue to litigate in state constitutions different types of provisions that are going to be thrown at us as in an effort to stop school choice.
Yeah, for the teachers' unions, it was never about constitutionality. That was just a means to an end, the end being maintaining their monopoly on education. The public schools work great for a lot of kids, but education should not be a one-size-fits-all. Every kid should have a choice of where to go to school, what school is best for them. And that's what we're working so hard for.
And a victory at the Supreme Court takes the biggest barrier that carries from state to state, as you said, 37 states.
Absolutely. It's the biggest barrier
off the
right
table.
Now.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Tim. Thank you, Erica. That concludes today's show. Thanks for watching. And if you like this kind of in-depth content from IJ about our work, please don't forget to follow us and to subscribe.